Welcome back to Lost in Citations. Today's guest is Dr. Paul Sylvia, professor at UNC Greensboro. Welcome back to Lost in Citations.
Thanks again for having me again, Jonathan.
This is the third time you've been on the show. The first episode was Citation 116, where we talked about your book, How to Write a Lot. The second time was Citation 131, where we talked about your book, Researching Daily Life, A Guide to Experience Sampling and Daily Diary Methods. Your co-author was your PhD student, right?
Yes.
And today we're going to be talking about an article that has been highly cited in your library, I guess we could call it, interest. Now, what's that line called? I always forget. It's not a semicolon. It's not a, what is that long line used in writing that I've seen in pop?
I dare say you are talking about the noble M dash, Jonathan. The
Yes.
noble M dash. Yeah, this is I don't know where I know this, but in typesetting in the old days of fixed line type, an M dash is the width of a capital letter M. So if you're setting type, if you're a compositor setting type, you have a few different dashes. One of them is a hyphen, which
Yep.
is usually a little bit lower on the letter line, and of course, tiny. And then you have the N dash, which is might be vanishing from the language, but has some useful functions as punctuation. That's the width of a capital letter N. But the M dash, that's what it does. Very,
You know
very
what?
handy.
I think you wrote about it in the book How to Write a Lot. Pretty sure that's where I read about
I do have a slightly unseemly attachment to M dashes.
it.
They are in William Zinsser's book on writing well. I think this is where I first really got a sense of M dashes.
Okay.
And he talked about how, like a lot of things in life, the first time you learn it, you can be caught with an almost like evangelical fire and maybe get a little bit excessive in ways that you're older self regrets. And he said M dashes are one of those things because it's a punctuation mark that technically is hard to misuse. Like it's hard to use and wrongly. And he's right. You can get into a lot of trouble. And when I teach writing, I encourage students to just be profligate with dashes just to get a feel for it. And oh, do they ever.
Yeah, I like the M dash as well. I use it in like a different way with, so interest, M dash, the curious emotion, M dash, something else. That's
Yeah,
what.
a colon really would be much more standard there. And I don't remember why I ended up with a dash. I think with that title, I think I might have had a comma just to be quirky or have a different sense. And I think the copy editor said this is awkward. What do you think about a colon or a dash? It's like, yeah, let's do that. Why not?
Oh, interesting. I thought this was your calling card where you're thinking, I'm gonna put an M dash in this title. I'm
I
gonna
haven't
do
thought
it.
of this for a long time, but I recall, since we're just rambling on tangents, I think that copy editors are like the great unsung heroes of all academic writing and publishing. And I guess it's a role that's just changed so much over the years, especially with large multinational for contract you know, for profit publishers that are trying to do as cheaply as possible. But I remember the copy editor on this paper just be very insightful and having a lot of cool ideas and catching a lot of things, and it was just sort of very keen-eyed. So I had forgot that, but yeah, I think this was just something, a suggestion he had, and I was like, wow, this is really a fun copy editor. He's really clicking, he's really vibing. So yeah, I think that's what happened.
I know in our first conversation, I said, do you ever think back talking to yourself as a child and saying, would you rather do something different? I think you could host a 4-hour radio show because we just spent 5 minutes and we haven't even got to the title of the episode. That's pretty impressive. We just spent 5 minutes on an M dash. So I
I
think.
think talking too much is an occupational hazard.
Well, that's good if you want to be a radio host. Better than having nothing to talk about. All right, so the article name is Interest M Dash, The Curious Emotion. This was written in 2008. Now I was looking in the citation list of the paper, and you cited your book. So the question is, I guess you've been interested in this topic for a while. You wrote a book on the same topic, right, in 2006?
Yeah, this was one of the first things I really got into in graduate school and studying sort of motivation and emotion, interest and curiosity. I'm not entirely sure how really grabbed me. It just and it's something that psychology and education has been writing about forever, but was really understudied, was sort of in a dry spell, and I was interested in it, and I wrote my graduate school papers on it. And it was late in graduate school that I thought, yeah, this would make for a cool book. So the ambition to write a book that kind of summarized the psychology interest was dates way back into the graduate school years. And it took a long time for the book to come to fruition, as books often do. It comes full circle a little bit because when talking about how to write a lot, part of the genesis of that book was just the woeful struggles of trying to write Exploring the Psychology of Interest, which was the first book I was trying to write on my own. And it just was just my progress was just dashed against the shoals of my first job. And it was, in a way, it was figuring out how to really productively write that book while having a real job and a life that was kind of the crucible for how to write a lot ultimately. Because that book was, I was probably sent four and a half years late to the publisher.
Oh, okay.
And the first and last book I ever submitted late to a publisher. Oxford University Press was weirdly tolerant about that one.
Talking about how to write a lot, I feel like I've hit a breakthrough in regard to that book, in that
So
I because the concepts always made sense to me, but I always struggled. I remember you had this line in our first interview where you feel sorry for people that approach writing. I think you said it, brick by brick, I approach my masterpiece, that kind of style. And I moved away from that dock slowly, started swimming to your side of the stream. But I think I've gotten to a groove where I can approach a passage because I'm working on the PhD. So, I had to accept a long-term sort of goal here, or this is going to take a long time. And I've kind of gotten the groove where I can sit down for 1 or 2 hours and approach a section and finish it off and be happy with it. And then come back to it
Right.
the next day, or come back to another section the next day. And then I look back over the course of a month and I look back at the writing. I was like, wow, this is actually pretty good. Like it's actually like
Good.
flowing together. So I don't know. I
Good.
didn't, I think it's one of those things like you have to have a mindset for the patience of it, where it's going to take a long time. I don't know if you explicitly wrote that in the book, where you need to take that step where you said, look, this is a long-term process. Even if it's a long-term process over the course of a week, does that make sense?
Yeah, it really does. I think when we first approach writing and we start doing writing in a serious way as students, we still think writing's really linear, like it has a start and it has a finish. And a lot of the metaphors for writing projects, like it's a marathon, not a sprint. It's like, well, it's kind of really neither in some ways. It might be more like mowing your lawn with a few breaks for drinks and a lot of swearing, and occasionally you have to turn off the lawnmower to grab a bunch of sticks, and perhaps you get chased by bees. It's more recursive, and there is a start and there is a finish, but there's not really a path there. And I think as people develop more experience and more expertise, a lot of things happen. One is that they become more patient with it, that they know it takes a while. And like if you're doing some writing and you just sort of stop and you're stuck and you're not sure what to say, I think beginners are like, oh, writer's block, how cruel. But experts will sort of be more metacognitive or reflective and say, this is a sign that I need to do more reading, or this is a sign I need to do more outlining. Like I'm glad I had this experience. It's telling me something about how I need to approach this. So, and I think your experience is common. I know like there's research on how beginners, when they think about writing, like little kids, I think writers know a lot of words, and being a good writer is like knowing a lot of words. And beginning writers at the student level spend way too much time on word choice and way too much time on sentence. Like the basic chunk of writing seems to get larger. Like as people become more expert, they start to think of paragraphs. Like you're not writing a word or a sentence, but you're writing paragraphs. And a lot of really experienced book writers say they really talk in terms of like think in terms of sections and even chapters, that the units become a lot more kind of holistic. I think that feels about right, just in my experience too.
And you've mentioned editors' comments a lot. I feel like I'm very fortunate with my PhD supervisors now. Before, I would when I was doing the master's in psychology, thankfully I'm not in the psychology field anymore. I mean, I guess I am tangentially, but technically I'm back to education. But when I was doing the master's degree in psychology, which I remember you labeled neat in our first conversation,
It is neat.
which I got a chuckle. When I would open the email to get the supervisor feedback, I was always kind of reading the email through my hands, kind of thing. But now the feedback is very interesting. And the question, like some of the questions that they, it's like, so for example, there was like one sentence comment by one of my supervisors in a section that it was a kind of a very short section. And then I took a lot of, I thought about it a lot, and I was writing. I was like, okay, this doesn't fit here. But then I kind of put it into another section. And then after a couple hours, I said, you know what? That was really productive. That was like a, re and then, I, and then like you say in How to Write a Lot, I moved on with my day, and I knitted a sweater for my cat and all those things. And then I came back to it the next day. So I'm really coming around to that. I'm able to shut it off. I don't think about it after I'm done for the, it might pop into my
Yeah.
head. So that's like a very healthy way to do it, I think.
It is. I think this is where, like, when professional writers talk about writing, I think people who aren't really heavy in any kind of creative field, they see a real opposition between an art and a craft. And like an art, it's about inspiration and innovation and emotional drama and big bursts of creativity out of nowhere and major advances, and that creative work is sort of boom and bust and unpredictable. And craft, that's just someone making barrels out of wood staves, or that's just, and whereas I think people who are really deep in these things, deep in the fine arts and deep in writing, really see them as sort of the same thing. Like the routine is the space for the creative work. Like the routine is how this comes together, that like a strong sense of craft is the foundation of really amazing creative work. And it's not going to happen without the time and the labored effort. And I think the routine of it, what you mentioned, is what I think we're all hoping for, is that the routine of it takes away that looming sense of dread, or this sort of the sense of projects always hanging over you. Like when you know you're going to get to it again soon, your brain doesn't hang on to it and try to remind you of it at awkward times. I really do think that's the most compelling part of a writing schedule, is people don't ruminate about whether they should be writing or if they're not writing. They can, like the blacksmith is going to be back at the forge, the next day, and they shouldn't wake up in the middle of the night wondering if they should start, banging metal or something.
All right, so let's get into this book, well, this paper. I mean,
Yeah.
it's 3 pages long, but there's a lot in this paper. And I would say I really enjoyed it.
No,
To
thank
go
you.
to skip to one of the concepts, the appraisal too, you talked about the comprehensibility. A lot of these concepts I'm familiar with. So I feel if you were a novice to this, like you'd have to do a lot of reading to understand it. I think you probably could still enjoy it, and it would still be interesting not to skip ahead to someone who doesn't know all the concepts. But there's a lot in this paper, And I can see why it's so heavily cited. I guess I wanted to start with this. So, have you ever heard of the sports journalist or podcaster or radio host? I don't really know what his title is. Bomani Jones. Have you ever heard that name
Oh,
before?
no.
Okay, so I think he was on ESPN. He had a couple television shows. Really smart guy. I'm not really sure what he's up to now, but I think this was back in 2014 or 2013, where podcasts weren't so ubiquitous. He was the first person that I heard do a podcast by himself, and I found it to be engaging. And I thought it was, now I think people do this more nowadays. I thought it was surprising that someone could sit and talk into a microphone by themselves for 20 to 30 minutes, and it would keep my attention. The one thing that one tool that I think he utilized. Okay, so the thing that really rubs me the wrong way when I listen to podcasts or radios when people use crutch phrases. And once I hear a crutch phrase, I'm kind of out. So if someone uses the word like too much, one crutch phrase in sports media nowadays is they'll say, "I'm interested to see how it's all going to play out." You hear this all the time, which essentially means nothing. Like, I'm listening to you to give your prediction. Who do you think is going to win the Final Four? So they'll just list all these factors that everybody knows, and then they'll say, "Well, it'd be interesting to see how it all plays out." So that's a crutch phrase. You're actually not saying anything. So anyway, one thing that I found that he used a lot, which is the opposite of a crutch phrase, he would use the word interesting all the time. He'd say, "And this is what I found to be interesting." And then that's kind of struck me as a word. If you're in radio or podcasting, and you don't know a word to use, you could always use the word interesting, which is a wide-ranging word. So
It is.
I kind of wanted to start with that. I consider the word interesting as a non-crutch phrase. Now I'm going to throw it back to you. I don't. It's not really a question there. Do you have any?
Well, I certainly find interesting this very interesting too. And it the whole example is a good one because people are have sort of very hungry brains. And they're very curious and they're always on the prowl for new information. And I think it sort of says a lot that it doesn't take a lot to tickle people's minds. And that also it doesn't take a lot of boredom for people to get kind of cognitively itchy and cognitively restless and need some more variety, need some more stimulation. And the mere fact that people are listening to this podcast is a sign that people are trying to, usually they're trying to occupy their minds. Like that they're probably not a professional podcast listener, although one hopes that becomes a job if you want a career change. People are at work, they're commuting or they're cooking, and they want to their mind just feels empty or jittery or curious and understimulated. Or they just would like to learn something they don't know. And I think like with that particular podcast, I think a quirk podcast host will often remark on this when they read reviews or talk about people. They always say they're surprisingly gratified that people who don't really know anything about the topic listen because they just find it interesting. I have a couple of sports podcasts I listen to where I don't actually watch the sport or even enjoy the sport, but I just find the podcast interesting, the humor, the charisma, but also that it captures kind of a truth about interest, is that things don't have to be important to somebody to be interesting. And in fact, it's part of what makes interest powerful and kind of profound is it's like the whole point of it that people can become engaged with something that might or might not be important and probably is important, but people are still motivated to check it out. And you might say, see how it plays out.
I gotta hate that phrase. I feel like I'm sorry to tell the listeners this, because once you hear it, you can't unhear it. It's one of those things, you wish you didn't know. Because anyone that listens to sport, at least American podcasts or even television, you'll and it started with I'm interested to see it's how it's going to turn out, and now they just change interest to a different adjective. And they're like, oh, I'm being edgy here. I'm curious to see how it's all going to turn out. It's of course we're all curious. That's why we're talking about the Super Bowl for 2 weeks. We want to know who's going to win. Tell us who's going to win. I'm curious. It's interesting to see how it all plays out. It's like, yeah, I know. That's why we're watching the game. Anyway, all right, so let's jump into the paper. You do an interesting thing here where the title of the paper is Interest, the Curious Emotion. And then one of the paragraphs, you kind of acknowledge the fact that it hasn't been widely accepted as one of the basic human emotions. I thought that was a very cunning move in your writing. What's your
Thank you.
You didn't come out and say in your writing, interest is a basic human emotion, but you did kind of allude to it in the title. What did the editor think about that?
So this as a backdrop, so this is a quirky journal in psychology where it's connected to one of the major scholarly societies, and they publish a they have a sort of portfolio of journals, but this one is unique in that it's review and summary articles that are all really short, and it's invitation only, in a loose sense of invitation only, meaning I think they invite people to write these really short articles, but I think some people can kind of catch invitations, if you know what I mean. And the idea is that, like, if you're teaching classes, like, these are good to use for readings in classes, or if we're just all way too busy to actually read something long or something short, it's a way of kind of keeping up with what's what in sort of a short way. So these current directions in psychological science articles need to be short, and you usually got asked to write one because you had a few papers come out and people like, oh, okay, this could this might you know might be of interest to our readers or represent something a little slightly new under the sun. And the context for it in emotion psychology, big field in psychology, it's very interdisciplinary, and like any big field of scholarship in any field, it's a little bit raucous, and there's lots of disagreements over the most basic stuff. And in psychology, these disagreements are hilarious because normal people also have ideas about it that are usually pretty good. I don't think the world at large has like strong feelings about major disagreements in like analytic philosophy or molecular biology, but normal people like have ideas about emotions, and humans have been interested in writing and thinking about emotions forever. And these ideas hold a lot of truth and value. And emotion psychologists, like psychologists of all stripes, sometimes just need to overcomplicate things just so that they're not just saying stuff that their grandma said, but with a lot of statistics. And I think this is a bit with so some theories of emotion would argue there's like very limited range of fundamental, like really, really basic emotions. And maybe four, maybe five or six, and they sort of stick to that and they have various criteria for it. Others are kind of looser. There are, of course, theories that say there aren't really actually emotions at all in the way people think about them. And but at the time this was being written, interest was not a lot of approaches to emotion spent a lot of time on it. A few would say this is like so clearly not an emotion, we don't want to talk about it. And others just, it didn't seem worth saying a whole lot about. But the ones who did say a lot about it were the ones that tend to be interested in things I thought was really interesting, like education, learning, and just human development, like how people learn from prenatally and birth to beyond, like just how people accomplish all the learning they had to accomplish. And these kinds of approaches, like, were the ones who were very passionate about interest, and we sort of emphasize this is like a really important emotion that does something really important for humans. Like really important lifespan tasks are accomplished with curiosity, and people are really curious for a reason. And This just kind of clicked with me. I think the debates on whether something is or isn't something tend to not be very productive, and I try to stay out of. But yeah, there was a small tweak to a certain side of the emotion crowd with that title, I guess.
Okay, so you said you're not interested in those types of debates. Why is that?
I think people can get. I think this is true of academia generally. People can get really deep in a hole over definitions of things, or whether something really, really, really is something, or really, 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 really isn't something. And in psychology, we always have to come back to like, what are people actually doing, actually like thinking? And an example, in the psychology of creativity and the arts, kind of my home field in many ways. So they can argue ceaselessly over what's aesthetic experience, and what are art like experiences for people, and what's the kind of things that the psychology art covers, and a lot of them are fancy European types who they're all into the fine arts. Aesthetic experience, we've got art and sculpture and fine arts and music. But if you look at like what aesthetic experience looks like for most people, it's things like picking colors to paint your wall for your apartment, and decorating yourself with clothes and makeup and jewelry, and finding backgrounds for your desktop and your phone. And a lot of what art engagement and art experience looks like for everyday people is sort of more humble and more mundane. And it doesn't matter if we want to call this artish or not. It's a really big part of what people are doing. Like, so we should learn about it.
Because I guess that's a long way around me asking you why I the how can I say this? So I was reading a book on a neuroscientist. Thankfully enough, he came on the show, Jared Cooney Horvath, and one of his chapters he was talking about emotions and feelings. And just like in your paper where you were talking about the components of emotions, kind of made a line of delineation between emotions and feelings. And I was in a group of people and they were talking about something, and I thought they were kind of blurring the lines between emotions and feelings. And I kind of put my hand up and I said, well, let's just make it clear that, jealousy is not an emotion or something. Because I just kind of had this information from a neuroscientist, breaking it down from that way. And then there was this almost this strong rebuttal, like, oh, that's not true. This is an emotion. And I was kind of flabbergasted because I thought, wait a second, this can't be true. And then I kind of posed it to Dr. Cooney Horvath, and he kind of said the same thing that you said. He said that he wouldn't engage in that debate because he's coming from the neuroscientist side, so he can break down like chemically what the brain is doing, and he can make this case that emotions are different from feelings. But he also would choose not to engage in that debate, which I think is kind of interesting, because how could you not engage in the debate if you feel like you have the information, right? Like, oh, I guess that would make sense. If you think that you're right and the other person's totally wrong, I guess you could like back off and say, well, this is wrong. But I mean, how can someone, how, there's a line between emotions and feelings, right? That's science, isn't it?
Yeah, I actually think there's a lot to be said for that. I think maybe a way to that I might approach that particular one is sometimes when people are saying like, this isn't in the category of things we study, so we shouldn't study it, or this isn't the category of things we study, so we should, it's not important. Or sometimes I think what they're getting at is, this isn't in the category of things we study, so I don't need to have theories of it. But I think a way to say it is like, so is jealousy an emotion? Is it more like a kind of a complex attitude? Is there some other word for it? I'm not sure, but it would be a really impoverished psychology of emotion that didn't have something to say about it. Like, this something that emotion psychologists should seek to understand really well. Like we should study it. I think there's just a kind of a weird Victorian formality to a lot of the social sciences sometimes, like that some things are just too indecorous or unseemly, and if they don't fit neat into a box, then you know we'll leave this for others to unpack. And so I think for like with interest as an emotion, like I think you know you could make a pretty good case for it. I think it seems sensible.
Yeah,
But even if it weren't,
I think you did make a good
you should
case
study
for
it.
it.
I think it.
I mean, like the process of an emotion is like we feel a sense. The sense goes to the amygdala, then the amygdala triggers an emotion, right? And then the hypothalamus releases the chemicals, and
I
that's the
think it's
physical
technically
sense.
called the hippopotamus.
And then the physical sensation of the emotion. That's the emotion. And then psychological interpretations of the emotion are kind of endless, and those would be called feelings. Now, that's how I understand emotions to be based on neuroscientists. You made it much simpler in your article where you talked about the components of an emotion. You also talked about one of the components of an emotion is that there's a subjective feeling. So you kind of categorized subjective feelings within an emotion, that emotions actually come with subjective feelings, which I thought that makes sense. That's kind of interesting.
I think the approach to emotion I always resonated the most with it comes out of sort of some European scholars, particularly a Swiss psychologist named Klaus Scher. And it's a much more tolerant and kind of like inclusive approach to emotion, which and I think one of the reasons is it comes grounded. It has a grounding in culture and in language, and it says we have to accept that, you know, emotions are very complicated. They exist in humans. They exist in many, many animals. And, you know, as Charles Darwin was kind of the first to point out, like it says a lot about human emotions that we can like peg the emotions of dogs pretty well. They can peg our emotions pretty well. He wasn't specifically talking about dogs in that way, I suspect, but, and that, you know, cultural concepts of emotion are so wide ranging. And sometimes we, you know, a lot of languages have words for emotions other languages don't have, but sometimes we can kind of, as outsiders to the culture language, we can kind of actually recognize the feeling when it's explained to us, but maybe for some we can't so well. And so this is an approach to emotion that's in some ways very loose and recognizes that there's probably emotions we have that we don't have good words for, that aren't captured by single words, and that it's kind of open to new entrants into the world of emotion. And it's more popular among people who are doing cross-cultural work and sort of cultural anthropological work, because it's not like here's the list of emotions and this is what they are. And perhaps it's just a much more, I guess some in all areas of scholarship, some schools of thought are just a little bit more open-minded, more willing to entertain new ideas and new entrants. And I guess this is one of them.
Yeah, but the way you pose this whole paper was based on the definition of emotions, which I agree with.
Yeah.
Like, so going
I
back
think
to
it's
like,
sensible. Yeah.
Well, a lot of, you know, when I first started getting interested in emotions was based on these research by Matsumoto, where he was comparing Japanese and American facial expressions.
Oh, yeah. Classic, classic work. Yeah.
And so then, you know, his whole thing is like, here are the six or seven basic emotions, and these are what we're all born with. He did this study where he analyzed the facial expressions of the Special Olympics judo team, because he was the coach of the American judo team. And then he analyzed the facial expressions of the Special Olympics winners. And he sort of proved that the facial expressions were the same. So that just because someone's born blind doesn't mean that they don't have the natural facial expression of the emotion.
Yeah,
So,
really classic work. Yeah.
Actually, I interviewed him. That was citation number five. If people
Oh
are
my.
in.
I need to scroll that Spotify back, huh?
Yeah. Now, as you might, anyone that's been listening to the show for a while, you might have noticed that I don't do as many interviews as before. I've adopted Dr. Sylvia's cave mode thing. That's one excuse. The other excuse is people are a lot more busy now that there's no COVID. So I doubt David Matsumoto would even pick up the phone nowadays. But
You never know.
at that time, he was literally in lockdown. I couldn't leave his house, so I was able to jump on that opportunity. All right, speaking on this topic of emotions, this is kind of out of left field a little bit. This is something that's always kind of bothered me as a knowledge base that I don't feel like at a cocktail party I could just, talk about. What's the difference between a sociopath and a psychopath? And the second question is, how does it specifically in the topic of emotions? Do they share the same similarities as far as like emotions? Because I've been really getting into the show. I already watched it, but the show Dexter.
Oh,
And that just got released on Netflix, the whole series. So I've been kind of like going back through it. And the whole concept is that he basically doesn't feel emotions. And it's a really funny premise for a television show because he's going through life sort of faking the emotions. And then as the audience, you've got this commentary about, oh, I should be upset here, but I really don't feel anything. So is he a sociopath? Or, again, what's the difference between a sociopath and a psychopath? And specifically in the regards of emotions, do they share characteristics or what?
Depending on who you ask, a lot of psychologists, particularly people in like personality psych or forensic psych, would see these as two different labels for the same thing. I think sociopath has I think is the word that kind of came a little bit sooner and kind of got like was more culturally prominent for a long time. Calling people sociopaths. And in psychology, they tended to prefer more like psychopath, or because they do make it sound fancier, psychopathy, and talk
Okay.
about sort of psychopathy and psychopathic traits. And this has been very interesting to people studying motivation and emotion for sure, because, I mean, it's just innately interesting, but also anything that leads to sort of antisocial behavior, particularly deviance and violence, is always worth studying. And an early idea that there's some merit to is that there's some sort of fear deficit, specifically deficits in fear processing and fear experiencing,
So
that
in the amygdala.
probably, and it's you can kind of imagine what life is like if you are not able to, if you're abnormally brave. Like a lot of things can happen there. So the idea that fear keeps you out of a lot of trouble and sort of prevents a lot of hijinks. And so this was an early theory, kind of a more like emotionally grounded theory of psychopathy, that this was maybe one of the cornerstones of it. Because one of the features of it is, moving away from like the lurid Dexter examples, is an impulsivity and an impetuousness. So it's not just, sort of a lack of empathy, or sometimes just expressed as callousness, like a callousness to other people's feelings, or lack of empathy for other people's feelings is a real cornerstone. Some would say like a meanness, like just a well, meanness, technical term there. But there's a kind of like an impulsive and impetuous quality to it that also is characteristic of a fear deficit, that people who are unnaturally old will get into trouble because it's hard to imagine bad consequences, and those bad consequences don't just feel scary, or people lack the natural wariness that keeps them out of trouble. So the You can kind of see like a lot of the deviance, propensity to violence, antisocial behavior, impetuousness, impulsiveness. Like some emotion psychologists say there's probably some similar roots there that have to do with aberrant fear.
So there's not really that big of a difference between the two words, the semantic thing?
Yeah, a lot of people would say so.
Okay.
But maybe this is just like sociologists and psychologists kind of having to carve out their own thing again. They're we don't always get along with their kind
I
here
see.
in
But
psychology.
this topic is inherently related to the topic of interest because although you didn't mention it by name in the article, you didn't mention the word boredom. You did sort of talk around the idea using the concept of sort of lack of stimulus or lack of activation or lack of arousal. So going back to the whole sociopath psychopath thing. So the whole idea of an emotion is like you have a sense, then the amygdala fires, then you feel the emotion. So it would make sense if you're lacking that ability in the amygdala to trigger it, then you'd be looking for an external arousal, which is nothing to do with the emo. You're actually trying to trigger it by like doing or like a thrill seeker, right? Jump out of an airplane. Your body's going to trigger some. Is that what like a sociopathic killer? Are they looking for the thrill? Because you kind of talked about impetuousness and impulsiveness. Does the thrill drive the action,
Oof.
or is it
That
the
honestly, I wouldn't know at that level. I think because when you're really getting to the level of like really deviant violence, there's probably a lot more going on. But if you turn the dial back more into sort of normal deviance, that's like a little easier to understand or to study. And yeah, like actually, there's a long tradition of work on. It kind of got started in the 60s on what they would call sensation seeking as a personality trait or sensation seeking behavior or thrill seeking. And it grew out of studies of boredom. And I think back in the 60s, something that was kind of hip at the time was sensory deprivation. People would, maybe this is coming back
It
again
is.
with,
It is.
everything old really is new again. And just an interest, like what, some people really struggle to tolerate this sensory deprivation, and it's challenging. They have unusual experiences like hallucinations, and it's a struggle. And as part of this work, they kind of identify there really does seem to be a cluster of people, or maybe just a normal dimension of personality, where some people are much more thrill seeking, and they do things to crank themselves up. So you see it in things like what kind of music do people like? Like there's clearly genres of music that just have so much energy to them. Certain kinds of, say, metal. They could play it really loud. There's a huge amount of acoustic energy there. And also the emotions there tend to be vigorous and often angry. You can drive fast. You could also do things that create big emotional thrills and not just physical thrills of, speeding, getting like powerful cars and speeding is a classic. You can bungee jump and jump out of airplanes, but you can also play contact sports, combat sports, but you can also do things like gamble. Like problem gambling is a big one. There's things that can create just a big rush, like just taking a risk is creates a huge rush. And so that's also part of it. And you sort of see in this like what stimulation seeking can kind of look like for people who are really motivated to stay stimulated and motivated for a lot of intense experiences and really need a lot of novelty in particular, like are easily bored. You can see that they lead interesting lives here, like they're living on the edge.
This is maybe like off the field question, which I think you respond well to, or
That's
you're.
my favorite kind of question.
So you've been in the field a long time, and you went through graduate school And ostensibly, you've made colleagues around the country and you've met people at conferences. Hey, what are you up to now? What are you doing now? Would you, there's been a history of hiring behavioral psychologists, in companies and, watching the show Mad Men, they have a psychologist on staff, right? That
Oh,
to
yeah.
inform. This is not necessarily something new. Did you find, because the more I read about this stuff, again, when I said the whole thing about it'll be interesting to see how it all turns out, right? This is the phrase that people have been saying, but now that you hear it, you can't unhear it. Once I start reading about, all these things, and then I start seeing how it's being, utilized, through video games or through social media and all these things, through the way companies leverage these. I guess the question is, A, did you see a rise in some of your colleagues or some people in the field that were in academia moving towards the private sector to be either, I don't know, in helping out private sector or even the government, right? Military. Did you see colleagues moving from academia into these fields? Or is it something you were ever interested in as far as like doing that sort of thing? Or have the rates of people leaving the field to be, hired in the private sector increased over recent years? Or
Yeah, I really think so. I think the pandemic caused a massive reshuffling in all areas of academia, people retiring early. I mean, just the nature of hiring and recruiting and faculty retention has been really different. But yeah, I think this was a big theme in higher ed of people leaving higher ed for industry. And in psychology in particular, the last psychologists have always been pretty heavily embedded in the private sector. Like much of psychology, like of its modern scientific form, really grew out of government, especially defense and intelligence spending around the time of Second World War, of trying to understand propaganda and persuasion and and intelligence and attention and so much of the rest of it. And I think in particular, technology companies, like looping it back to interest and curiosity, the last 15 or so years have they are heavily interested in this topic for better, but kind of mostly for worse. And I think, yeah, there's some, there's questions to be asked about what psychologists are doing with psychology and if it's always in the public interest. So psychologists who study close relationships, working for dating apps and finding ways to help people find good matches sooner. Sounds like a noble way to improve human connectedness. But I think especially with novelty seeking and curiosity, I just feel like so much of that knowledge has just been weaponized to turn people into little dopamine, endless scroll zombies, just looking for hits. And it's actually something I find sort of irritating and sad about the field, just like looking back on interesting curiosity the last 20 years, that it's, I think people's natural curiosity and need for new information is kind of being used against them to sell them ads for really cheap apparel and electronics coming from the other side of the world.
Yeah, I wonder what it would feel like to be in the field as a graduate student or enter academia and then understand these concepts and then getting a job offer from, a private company or the military where you feel like you're applying your skills like to a real thing and you're sitting in the board meetings and you're giving your input. I'm curious how that would, 'cause I saw this interview. I can't remember who did it. It was the lead psychologist for the army, or he was in charge of the Abu Ghraib, not Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, Guantanamo Bay. He was involved, and there was this long form interview with him, which I thought was pretty brave of him because I think there were all these, militant organizations that want to kill him because they know, they know who he is. And there was this long form interview, did you think it was moral applying these tactics to the interrogations? And he said, well, morality is more towards what the government law is at the time And the law at the time was accepting this. They're like, do you believe that this is torture? He's like, well, that's up to the government to decide. But, you know, and he talked about his motivations for getting into it because one of the psychologists that he knew in the military were killed or something. And it was a very interesting kind of thing where you're looking at this psychologist who is in a field where maybe he didn't even expect himself to be in. And then there's all this morality concepts going on. That would almost be kind of an interesting study of the psychologist because you'd think like when you watch
Yeah.
Mad Men, those psychologists in the board meetings are almost bullied sometimes. Just like Dexter's kind of bullied in The Office, like he's the blood spatter. Oh, you got that report yet? Come on. He's like bullied. Now he doesn't care because he's kind of, you know, a sociopath. He doesn't feel the emotion. He accepts, oh, this guy's kind of being mean to me right now. He doesn't really care. But I wonder like how that would affect a psychologist in those situations, right? Especially if they're the only one in the company. It's not like they have a team of people. Like they're the lead psychologist. I don't know. That's kind of a tangent, but that kind of interests me.
Yeah, and some of them will have, like, depending on the area, some of them will have some sizable teams. And
Okay.
there is always the question of what is this for? It's an interesting tangent of a tangent, but the American Psychological Association really fractured over this issue of psychologist participation in torture
Oh.
during that period. They lost tens of thousands of members. There was a For listeners who are curious, you can just Google the Hoffman Report. And the core question is, does the American Psychological Association see it as ethical for psychologists to take part in this, given that the American Medical Association and so many other associations say that it's not and that you can't take part? And the American Psychological Association was in bed with the military. And like a lot of scandals, it's like complicated and in some respects like incredibly tedious with like a large cast of characters. And it ends in books and lawsuits. But it is it's like anything else. If you do feel that you understand people well, how are you going to use that knowledge? So like to take something on my mind, it seems we always seem to talk around the time of the college basketball tournament. It's
I
March
know, it's
Madness.
funny.
And so, what's advertised on TV here? Alcohol and gambling mostly. Like that seems to be mostly what's advertised on TV for shows that American men are watching. And so we know a lot about this in psychology. We know a lot about addictive behaviors. We know a lot about problem drinking. We sure know a lot about gambling. I mean, gambling is just the motivational processes of reward and anticipation, and gambling have been known for, 70 years. It's easy to make rats addicted to things that have a gambling-like structure. And so yeah, these companies hire a lot of psychologists, a lot of data scientists, and it's hard to think like, we also know how to design these things in ways that make them less gripping, but they're not hiring the psychologist for that. Like we know how to make gambling apps and commercials in ways that are less likely to just pull these levers. And the first way would be honestly to not advertise them on TV. But you do have to wonder, like, is the broader question of is knowledge being put to good purpose here?
And
It's not,
also,
Oppenheimer and the bomb, but at the same time, a lot of families are going to be ruined by the coming wave of problem gambling in the United States.
and
And
you're talking
psychologists are playing a role in that.
and the levers you talked about and the degree. I was talking to this guy, he works for an airline company in America. And he was telling me that whoever designed the software for, the scheduling, is a total genius. The problem is when these pilots look at their schedules, it's kind of right under the bar of what is allowed legally, right? Like of how much sleep they're allowed to have. And he says every now and again, the pilots will kind of get together and say, hey, crank it back a notch. This is too much. and the company will oblige and crank it back. But that sort of implies that there is this crank, right? You can turn it up. Like, how much are these companies turning it up? You know, to the degree that they can turn it up, right? Are they going to the max all the time? I'm also curious in that, right? Like, is there more levers to be pulled?
Yeah, and I think you see,
Who's
like, when
regulating it?
if you look at the history of like, take a company like Facebook, right, which certainly has more than its fair share of psychologists and knows quite a bit about how to press human buttons to get people to spend more time with their product. Like, you know, they have times where people talk about nice mode or mean mode, and there are dials you can set that change the emotional complexion of it, that change people's engagement with it and the feelings they have and how much time they spend. And they know the psychology of this well. They're just using it for insidious purposes.
Yeah, like my
And
daughter, she's 11, and from last year, she started walking home by herself. Sometimes we would come home maybe an hour after her. So she has a key, she'd come home. We got her a phone, so she'd send us a message online. In Japan, that's sort of the ubiquitous SMS. And of course, if things have progressed to a point where, well, you know, get her Spotify, right? You know, she likes listening to music. I already have Spotify. You know, we get the family plan. She's line messaging. It kind of came to a head the over because she's on her spring vacation, and I just thought she was her phone. She's always had her phone. She's 11 years old. There's always a good reason for it. You know, she could justify it. We kind of had to have this talk where we had to scale things back. And I didn't realize this. I should have, maybe I'm not as good as a parent as I thought I was. Her notifications were all on for everything. And I said, "Are your notifications on? Like, turn those off." She's like, "What?" I was like, "Yeah, you can turn notifications off." And so that was like a big step, and I could actually see like a switch in her. She kind of be like she would she I was like, "You're turning into a zombie. Like, we need to get you off this thing, right?" And it was a hard parenting thing because my parents didn't have to do this with me. Had to sit her down and say, "Look, you didn't do anything wrong. The phone's designed to like get you distracted and get you in this state and make you a zombie. It's meant to be addictive." We had to have this conversation. You know, now from now on, you know, no notifications. We actually have these parental settings where, okay, only this much of time per day, no phone after dinner. I gotta say, even after 2 days, she just looked like I felt like I got my daughter back. She was a smiling kid again. It's kind of scary stuff.
Yeah, and it's yeah, on the one hand, you have large teams of behavioral scientists and statisticians, and on the other hand, they say, well, you just have personal choice and responsibility not to use it. And framed that way, you see these are not really fair fights. Like, one side has a lot of scholarship and science and theory, and it's being used to manipulate people in ways that they wouldn't necessarily concur with. And like, no one joins Facebook so they can just be mad, or no one gets their phone so they can just sort of stare at it. Like, they start for one reason, but then they get sucked in, and it maintains for others. You know, the iPhone commercials don't start with like, "Hey, get this cool phone so that you can just sort of sit around with your friends and all stare at it independently, like little toddlers doing parallel play, not interacting with each other, but just physically near." But that's what ends up happening. And yeah, the psychology of addiction is like a big part of the psychology of motivation. And I think with where curiosity and interest hits, it really is with these kind of novelty hits, like notifications are an example, endless scrolls and social media, the idea that something is happening right now and you need to observe it. And, you know, of the next 10 tweets that just came out, most of them will be mundane and boring, but there might be one that's really funny, but you don't know when it is, and you need to check. And it's just this, it's not always going to be a hit, but it might be sometimes unpredictably. And these are the kind of contexts that get this kind of more compulsive information seeking that resembles a lot like kind of compulsive lever pushing and sort of gambling type behavior that The occasional unpredictable reward is a really gripping thing for people.
Well,
That's the
and in
kind of thing
the
that keeps people scrolling.
article, you talked about, what is interest, right? Stimuli high in novelty, complexity, uncertainty, and conflict. These things enhance arousal, right? So it kind of got me thinking, like, how social media became this sort of really dark place of like conflict. And then going back to the whole lever pulling thing, like, what if we just took conflict out, novelty, complexity, uncertainty? That doesn't have to be so dark. I mean, they must know that conflict draws
Oh, yeah.
interest. So,
Yep.
yeah, it feels like those are moral dilemmas or moral conversations that people should be having. I guess, yeah, you could always make the argument, yeah, it is personal choice, right? Yeah, I don't know. It's not really going anywhere with that, but.
But that's always going to be the argument of people who are making money off of making it hard for you to make that choice. We might say in a certain side of psychology. Like personal choice is a sad match for, billions of dollars of psychologists and data scientists on payrolls of gambling companies and advertising companies. Like
Yeah, there was a certain, I don't know when I learned this fact. Maybe other people have known this for a long time. There's like data that shows that a gambler is always at the highest right before the result comes. So win or lose, the high is always, while the ball is rolling or whatever, right? So that means the addiction's going to come no matter if you win or lose. So the gambling company's always going to win. You're
It
always going to
really
come
is.
back.
It is boring if you always won a little bit. It's a little bit like, and this is where, say something like Twitter, or where there's things popping up in a feed. It would be bad if, say, 10 new things pop up. It would be bad if all 10 were appealing and interesting and funny and grabby. Like it's much more compelling if somewhere between 0 and 2 out of those 10 are unpredictably. That of every 10 things, maybe none of them are interesting, but next time maybe 2 are, and next time maybe 1 is. It's the kind of unpredictable reward, the kind of erratic, inconsistent, like it will happen eventually, but you're not sure when. That's what kind of gets this kind of more compulsive information seeking. Which is a lot like gambling. Like if the slot machine pays out every 10 times, it's gripping in a really different way than it will sometime unpredictably. And that's what creates the kind of the engagement, the flow, the rush, the more kind of compulsive side of the novelty-seeking behavior. If you could, it would be better to seed these kinds of information feeds with boring and indifferent material, just so that you kind of create this sparkle and pop when it does come, that gets people coming back in the future.
Yeah, you talked about, within person and between person variability. I thought that was really interesting. You made that point, which is one, a person might be interested in something, but when they totally understand it, then it could become boring, right? And that's true with video games, right? If you're too overpowered in a video game in the beginning, it's not interesting. So they got to keep your attention. Like over time, you have to go on side missions and you have to pick up more skills so you could beat this boss. But then after a certain point, yeah, a video game is discarded. It could be interesting for 70 hours. And then all of a sudden, oh, I'm too powerful now. I can just beat everyone. I already know all the maps. I know all the secrets. It's done. So it's kind of cool when you think about it in that way, how video games. I don't really have anything against video games. I think I'm more against like social media.
Yeah, I would
You
agree. If you look at the long body of writing on interest and curiosity in different fields, and even just the language and words people have used over the many years as sort of synonyms, I think some we need to bring back. And one is the notion of something being diverting, that things that are interesting In the past, some of us said this is a diversion or this is a diverting activity.
Hmm.
There's a bit of a judgment to that, that this is a diversion from moral education, diversion from the somber reflection appropriate a husband and a gentleman. But also, you know, it's a diversion from something more meaningful. And I think that's like a good word for what a lot of this kind of listless novelty seeking and information grazing behavior is. It's, I think to call it like a diverting flavor of interest could help kind of highlight that it's not constructive and that it's not building new relationships. It's not building new knowledge. It's not building new skills. It's not expanding your mind. It's just kind of hitting some emotion buttons over and over and over. Just compared to things that, you know, people will find like really compelling, interesting, that do lead to like real growth in knowledge or growth in relationships, or that kind of aids in human development in some more meaningful, fruitful way.
Yeah, I liked you talked about kind of this Venn diagram between complex and understandable.
Yeah.
And then you tied that into our favorite psychologist who talks about flow, who I still can't pronounce. You told me how to pronounce his name last time.
Csikszentmihalyi.
Csikszentmihalyi. Dang it. And that makes sense, right? So someone at the top of their game, skill set wise, but they're doing a complicated task within their field, they could feel that sense of flow. They're like kind of
Yeah,
moving the carrots right ahead of them and can keep their attention, right?
I think if you look at, a lot of the coolest writing and interesting curiosity has always come out of education and education theory, you know, starting with John Dewey in some ways, like one of his more obscure, really fun little books from the early 1900s called Interest and Effort in Education. It's neat. And a theme in these is that, like, if you look at what really has absorbed people over the years, like people have developed like a lot of expertise and maybe it's like a long-term hobby. In academia, we can all relate to this because we're studying and researching and writing books on things that are incredibly niche and obscure, really, but we just find fascinating over many, many years. And the things that the kind of domains that where this happens, they tend to just be open-ended, where the more you learn, that just enables you to learn more. So learning sort of begets more learning. Like the more you learn about something, it just opens up new things that you can understand. We talk, you know, people often talk about becoming wiser or more nuanced, or that the more you learn about something, it's both so much more complicated, but also so much more unified all at the same time. And people talk about their knowledge becoming richer and deeper. And the more you know about something, it's easier to find more things about it interesting because you can see more distinctions and see more connections. And it's a cool quality of like really long-term, deeply interesting things to people that it, unlike a video game where you just kind of hit an end and it's over, these things have no real ceiling. Like there's the things that to grip someone for a lifetime, things are just vast and open-ended. There's no real end to how much you can learn and how much you could know. And that seems to be part of what's really satisfying about these things to people, the fact that it can just go on infinitely.
Well, I don't want to take too much of your time. Maybe we'll close with a question about my field. This paper
Sure.
is really interesting, to use my non-crutch phrase. For people in a wide range of fields, if you're interested in intrinsic motivation, if you're interested in appraisal theory, if you're interested in flow, if you're interested in emotions and feelings, lots of things. If you're interested in textbook development, there's a nice little section on that, which I liked. But I guess for me, you know, I teach in not a high tier private university, where a lot of the classes I teach are compulsory English classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the biggest struggle I have is, so for a long time, I've been trying to find a way to say this is how English can be relative to your life, and this is how maybe your life can get better. But unfortunately, as the years go by, I don't know if Japan's becoming more isolationist, or I don't know what's going on. If you look at the statistics, the literacy of English in Japan is falling rapidly, where Singapore is number one in Asia. Japan just keeps falling. And I survey my students every year, and it seems like a large majority of them can't think of one single time that they'd really need English in their life. A lot of them are content to never leave Japan. They don't think they're going to use English in their future company. And again, this is in my context, my specific case study context, right? So I'm always kind of struggling with how can I make them interested in this topic? And even when I show them movies or I'll show them something that I found interesting, like a sign, I stopped doing that because it was so soul crushing. I remember showing this episode of Seinfeld, and it was like I was showing them a film on how to stare at a wall for 2 hours. I mean, it was like no response, deadpan, nothing. And I thought, I can't do this. And then I talked to teachers like, oh, there's a woman who's from England. She's like, oh, I play them Beatles things. And oh, and you should really do that because you could like share what you find interesting. And maybe she was a different context than me. So I kind of almost, I'm afraid to show them things that are interesting. I mean, so I'm thinking about it with this article, complex yet understandable. But I struggle to get them to find English interesting. I really do. And I don't know if you have any advice on that.
I think this is actually this kind of context is the kind of reason why I think it's people in education, from theorists to people in the trenches, that have always had the most to say and the most to ask about interest and curiosity, because it's just like this really obvious engine for learning, engine for motivation. And it really is true. When people find something interesting, just learning feels a lot more effortless and a lot more rewarding, a lot more fun. And it's never more apparent than when people are just like not interested in what they have to do. I think everyone teaching in a department, there's always at least a couple classes. Someone what's called the, some kinds of teaching are like the battlefield medicine of teaching, where it's just you're just trying to stop the bleeding and hand them off to specialists. And yeah, this is
Like
a
that.
big part of what John Dewey's little book was about 100 and something years ago, where he was talking about interest and effort as ways of getting people to learn. And by effort, he really meant kind of like rote methods, like we're just going to drill and drill and drill and drill and drill, and the learning comes through the work. And he was equally critical of what he called like the interest approach, which is to make things sparkly and shiny and diverting, and to make things, the edutainment, we might call it these days. And he said this isn't going to work either, because it doesn't really connect to anything. Like it really is interesting and entertaining, but it's the students just are entertained by the entertaining thing, and they don't draw the connection or make the step or make the link. And his idea, which is so much easier said in a book than done, is he says, if you it's the essential truth I think all teachers sort of know, like if you can connect it to things that they care about, they will care about it more naturally. Like if it's in the service of a goal, like an idea of, I think, learning sheet music. Like it's really hard to teach someone how to read sheet music if they don't really want to play an instrument. But if they really want to play an instrument and you just kind of get them started, then you can get them into reading sheet music, and they will often really want to do it because they can see like they need to learn this so that they can keep on rocking on the ukulele. And so his idea is, if you could kind of connect, you're almost like you're plugging something into something they're already motivated to do. Now, the challenge is, of course, does it connect? Or are they motivated to do anything that you're aware of or that you can kind of have contact with? And I think that's the struggle a lot of us are having, In psychology, it's with like sort of statistics, data analysis kinds of classes, which are important to the field, but not important to our students. And honestly, not important to what they're eventually going to go and do. They just kind of have to take them for curricular reasons and accreditation reasons. And it's a struggle. It is. And someone once told me sometimes you can just ask them, like what, and if they're like, what are ways that the English connects to what you care about? What might be ways, like what are things that you might think we would never talk about or learn about? What are things that, like, if you're completely fluent in English, what might you do? What might, yeah, and just you never know what they might say. It might be at least a place to start. Sometimes if they're not connections, it's, I mean, I think this is maybe just my own sense of lore, but rather than anything really from interest, but I think sometimes things are easier, some context where it's like, okay, this is something that's not close to your heart, but it's something that is important for us to learn, and we're going to do our best here. And some things aren't thrilling, but they're important, and we can get something out of it, and maybe we'll find it more interesting as we go through it. And I agree. A lot of the people who write about interest write more broadly about academic motivation, motivating the unmotivated, and there's a reason why we don't have any answers to this. Some people are like part of the between person part. Some people are just so much more innately curious than others, and it doesn't take very much to make them interested in things. Some people are just much more practical and down to earth and not as curious about things, and that's okay too. And there, it's a little bit, that lever is a little bit rustier and harder to pull sometimes. And sometimes that's part of it too. But mostly I just sympathize with your plight on a lot of days around here.
Yeah, I think you're right though. I think I can approach it more open-ended questions, or different kind of questions. I think some of these students, unfortunately, are lost before they get to me. And there's a perfectionist aspect of Japanese society as well, where people just concede, like, oh, well, I can't do this. I can't speak English. Like, it's like either perfect or nothing. And so then that ties to your thing about they've just accepted that this is not understandable. So I will do the bare minimum to get through this process because it's uncomfortable or something. So.
Yeah, I mean, if anything is, emotions don't really have opposites, but in a way, if there's kind of an opposite of curiosity, it's probably fear and anxiety. And new things are scary, and new things are also interesting. And one of the things that really does inhibit people from trying new things is that they think it's scary, but with like behaviors and activities, it's often, I mean, perfectionism is a big one. It's like, if I can't do this really well, why do I want to do it at all? Like, it's a waste of time to invest in it if I can't be great. And that is really destructive because it makes it hard to just enjoy it for its own sake, or just to play with something, or just to have fun with something. The belief that if you're not great at it, it's not worth doing. That's really a joy killer right there. And really, that really stunts curiosity. And I could believe in Japanese higher educational culture, that's a big one.
And those are the greatest teachers. And I would say that I am not one of those. Someone who is really skilled at something, but then can make it, attainable to someone, to a novice. Like a lot of experts in the field of whatever it is, if it's sports or academia or whatever, they're what they find interesting, maybe teaching it would be like boring. It's like too, they don't want to, they don't. It, so when someone who's trying, to or it's exposed to a topic and it faces those per that can really turn off someone for the rest of their life because they're so good at it, but then they can't understand why someone can't understand something. And so, but there are teachers who are great at their field, and they can still make it interesting to someone who's a novice. It's a great skill, something I don't really have.
I agree. I have always found it harder to teach about things that I know a tremendous amount about. I think if I'm teaching about something that I have less expertise in, I think I can just approach it with kind of the beginner's mind of like, whoa, this is neat, and whoa, this is neat. And I can sort of see it a little bit more from a student's perspective and pull out like, this is like the cool stuff, as opposed to just jumping on all these obscure distinctions and hobby horses that we get into. Always found it harder to teach about my own work and my own areas, for sure.
Last thing, we were ships crossing in the night last summer. I was in North Carolina.
I know.
And you were in Washington, D.C., right?
Was pretty funny.
Very bizarre.
I hope you can make it back down here again sometime, though. We could
That
cross
was,
paths.
yeah, I was in Holden Beach. Are you familiar with that beach?
Yes. Ooh, is that next to Oak Island? Is
Not sure.
that area? I'm not sure either. Yeah, not very far away. The beaches are nice out here.
Yeah, it was a great time. So that was funny. I was staying in DC for a couple weeks, came down to the beach for a week, North Carolina, and you went to DC for a week. So ships crossing in the night. All right, so
One of these days.
the article is Interest M Dash, The Curious Emotion, 2008. Dr. Paul Sylvia, thank you so much for coming on Lost in Citations.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks again for having me.
If you'd like to contact the show, the best place to find out about us is our website, lostincitations.com. Here you can learn more about the background to this project and how you can get involved. Our hope is to help academics, educators, and online content producers get in contact with each other. Our email address is lostincitations@gmail.com. We also have Facebook and LinkedIn pages. Please rate and comment on the sites you use to download your podcasts. It helps us reach more potential listeners. But probably the most helpful thing you can do is, if you like our content, recommend it to a friend and let them know what we're trying to do. Thank you very much.